Video. So my name is Todd A. I work for our NOAA Fisheries, in particular the Northwest Fisheries Science Center, which is located up in Seattle near the University of Washington. And just a quick blurb about NOAA Fisheries. So we're one of the six line offices within NOAA. So NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Probably the bigger office that you heard of is the National Weather Service. So that's like our one of the main offices that we have within NOAA. But then there are five other line offices as well, one of which is NOAA Fisheries. NOAA Fisheries in particular is kind of responsible for basically sustainable fishing. Pretty much up and down all the coastal regions of the U.S. So we basically handle and are responsible for fishing from the 3 miles out to 200 miles, which is a U.S. economic exclusion zone. From 0 to 3 miles, that's handled by the states. And so my organization, which is the Northwest Fisheries Science Center, we basically do all the science that then feeds into the policy and regulatory decision-making for West Coast fishing. And so basically what I'm going to talk about today is I'll give you a little bit about kind of a little of the history of the West Coast fishing. Sometimes you hear about really the depletion of stocks and resources out in the oceans. I'll talk a little bit about that. I'll talk about some things that have been done here on the West Coast to try to alleviate those problems. And I'll get a little bit more in detail about what my group in particular does. So just a quick blurb on that is, so within the Northwest Fisheries Science Center, I work in a division called the Fishery Resource Analysis and Monitoring Division. And our division, we basically do all the surveys up and down the West Coast. So we do scientific surveys. We also do what are called stock assessments, which is basically where we try to ascertain how many fish of a given species are out there, and then we drive that information into a regulatory decision-making process to be able to set stock limits. So how many Chinook salmon you could harvest in a given year, or how many Pacific Ocean perch, that sort of thing. And so we'll get started with that. So here's kind of the quick blurb about, again, what NOAA Fisheries is about. The big piece where I'm really involved is in that sustainable fisheries sector. And again, my particular role within this FRAM division is I'm actually a data scientist, so I lead our data team there. So we collect all this research data, we process it, we do a bunch of analysis on it, and then we feed that in the decision-making process. So I'm kind of in the key mixture of getting working with the data, helping to collect it, and then also process it to feed these stock assessments. So before I get too far down the road, who are the students in here? Okay, so we've got a lot of students in here. So what I'd like to do, this is going to be a collaborative approach. So I'm going to give you about half an hour, 40 minutes worth of information, and I'll expect some questions from you. So to help with that process, students, please raise your hand. Once again, just hold them up. We'll at least have a couple of questions from a few of you. So who's looking smart today? How about you, right back there? You'll ask one question. How about you, right there? You'll ask the second question. And everyone, students, get those hands back up. Who's looking smart today? Would you like to ask a third question? How about?
Yes.
Okay. So at the end of it, you have a good 20 minutes or so. You're going to hear a lot of topics, ask me a question, and challenge me by all means. So that's what NOAA Fisheries is about. So I'm going to give a few slides. I got a few videos in here, a little more informative than what's all there, but that was kind of a quick blurb is that these are the types of things we do. We have marine biologists, we have oceanographers, we have a whole smattering of different folks out there doing really interesting work. So ask questions. You're more than welcome to ask your questions along the way as well. You don't need to wait until the end. So where do we start? So, you know, there's been fishing up and down the West Coast for a long time. In about 82, I think they postulated, is when we really hit a peak fishing era where we'd really been fishing a lot. And stocks were really starting to be depleted at that point. Well, in about 2000, this particular passage comes from a report from the Nature Conservancy Group. Well, in about 2000, a federal emergency declaration was declared saying, hey, we have overfished stocks on the West Coast. We need to do something about it. The science had started catching up. We started figuring out how we could do these stocks assessments that I talk about, and I'll show you a little bit later what those are. But they came out, they made this emergency declaration, and then they started making some changes in the policy. A little bit about fisheries as well. Fisheries is driven by something called the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is from the 70s. It was basically an act to help promote sustainable fishing for the U.S. And that's really the big regulatory or the big legal statute that we rely upon for all of our regulatory body that we run. That's a big one. Endangered Species Act is another one. So we work very closely to try to get certain species removed from the Endangered Species Act list. So 2000 was a big turning point, emergency declaration. What happened then in 2003 is we had just a lot of vessels out there trawling, doing hook and line surveys, pot surveys and whatnot. They're actually fishing, right? And they're overfishing the population. So what happened in 2003 is we actually, NOAA came back and they had this buyback program. And this actually predates my time with NOAA. I've only been with NOAA for a couple years now. But they basically went back and bought back vessels and bought back the vessels' rights to fish. Because they realized we are just overfishing this and we're going to lose all of our stock. Whereas, so that was pretty proactive move to happen here. Whereas you hear a lot on the East Coast where they still have stocks that they've completely decimated and they have not recovered yet. And so on the West Coast, we caught it a little bit earlier and we've been able to actually make some very good progress. And I'll show you towards the end of this a video that shows kind of the state of the stocks and how some of them are actually being removed from the ESA list and whatnot. So anyways, this was a big deal. We've ended up buying back vessels, buying back fishing rights as well. I don't know, this is just a quick chart, but this kind of shows you how much, it was to the tune, the original amount was to the tune of like $46 million, but this kind of shows you, this is just from last year, November of last year. The big one is that one up top, what we call our limited entry trawl survey, or trawl fleet. So trawling is, it's a pretty intense operation, right? You take a big net, you drop it on the bottom of the ocean, and you just start harvesting. You pull up everything you can get down there. And it can be a very destructive process when you do it. But they also, you pull up a lot of fish when you do that. But that was a big one where we really targeted saying, hey, we need to reduce the trawl fleet in order to try to get our stocks back in order. So what that then precipitated was this whole program called West Coast Groundfish Catch Shares. And this has really been pretty foundational to the whole recovery effort. This produced something called over there on the right, the Individual Fishing Quota, IFQ. How many people here have heard like carbon cap and trade? Show of hands. So you basically set a limit on how much carbon you can have out there, and then you can buy and sell your rights to produce carbon. It's basically the same thing but for fish stock. So now all of a sudden, an individual fisherman has certain amount of rights to basically go and fish for this many pounds of, say, sable fish, or this many pounds of cod or whatnot. That's what IFQ is all about. So they have this whole system where they can go and see how much they've used. If they're short and they've overfished on a certain species, they can try to trade that with another fisherman and whatnot. And it's actually worked out quite well. And so this catch shares program came around in 2011, and that's really been another big piece that really helped to start recover our stocks. Fishing gets complex. You think, hey, you're going out there, you're catching a fish. You try to sell to a buyer. There are all sorts of permits and legal registrations that you go through to figure out what you can get. So this is a smattering of some of the various types of different fishing vessels you can use, the different gear you can use, the different fisheries you're going after. So like at the very top, you see that limited entry trawl. So you need a federal permit. It's the gear you're gonna use. It's a bottom trawl gear. It tells you like how big your boat can be, what depths you can operate at and whatnot. And very critical is over there on the right-hand side, those two right columns, that talked about the management plans that we had in place for how we're gonna manage those particular types of fishing. So it changed again in 2011 over to that IFQ portion. So you see where it says IFQ. So another critical thing you're gonna see out there is, actually I think I can do this in the next slide. Right here. So how it works is fishermen goes out, they bring in all their fish. First thing they do is they go to a fish buyer basically, right? A big plant that they're gonna buy at the stock that they just caught. So that buyer basically issues them the fish ticket. So this is all the fish you bought out there. That information floats over to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is either Oregon, Washington, California, that's where we work. And then that finally goes into the system called PACFIN. So that's kind of what we call our retained catch. That's what a person basically went and harvested, and then they actually retained because they're gonna sell out at market. Well, there's also this notion of discarded catch, or what we call bycatch. This is fish that they may actually harvest when they're out there, they just throw it right back over the sea because it's not profitable for them. So that fish is just tossed. So that's called discard. What that IFQ program did was it also instantiated a program called the Observer Program. Officially, it's called the West Coast Ground Fish Observer Program, where we actually put a person on each of these trawl vessels who monitors what they're throwing overboard. So that goes against their quota now. Whereas before, it would just get thrown on the board and we'd have no idea. They could have tossed over a bunch of fish and we'd have no idea about it. Now we actually monitor it. And that's been a huge thing. You gotta have a policing or a law enforcement action on it to make people do the right thing sometimes. Question?
Is the bycatch, is that like the fish are still alive or is it like after they've like gone through everything?
Yeah, but by the time these fish, like this is a trawl, it's pretty much by the time the fish come up, they're pretty much dead. So not always. Sometimes you can get some fish. A lot of them have swim bladders in them, so those will be burst out through their mouth or whatnot, and so they certainly won't survive. But some of them that don't have that, you can still try to get some of them back in the water, but that's not really what the concern of the fishermen are doing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that right now. So that was a big piece. We could really monitor. We know what the retained catch is. We know what the discard is. So we really have a complete sense of hey, what's happening to the stock out there. Then the third piece is, there's a regulatory requirement now, is they actually have to deliver to us all of their economics. How well are they doing? Are they a financially viable fleet out there? And so we actually collect that information as well, so we can see what their net revenue and earnings are for any given year. And again, we're trying to ensure not only the welfare of the ecosystem out there, we want to ensure the stocks are doing well. We also want to ensure that the communities of fishermen are surviving as well. So we're very interested in kind of the full aspect of fishing here. So let me just say here. So I'll throw up a few little blurbs. So this is where my division is involved, wherever you're going to see the little NOAA stamp. So we do the observer program in my division. We do the economic data collection program in my division as well. Then a third thing we do, which is really critical, are stock assessments. These are the scientific models that we come up with to try to determine what are stock assessments. So here I'm going to go into a quick video that talks about it.
Sound science. We manage about 450 stocks nationwide, including 230 of the most valuable fish stocks. A big challenge to studying these stocks is that fish are mostly invisible to us, and the ecosystems in which they live are always changing. Let's take a closer look at the science behind managing one of those stocks, the Pacific hake fishery. Also known as Pacific whiting, it's one of the top five fisheries in the United States by weight, and one that was worth $52 million in 2011. The hake fish population has natural and unpredictable ups and downs. We want to take as many hake from the ocean as possible, but still leave enough behind to sustain the populations year after year. That's where fishery science comes in. NOAA fishery scientists take a research ship out to sea to collect data on Pacific hake. They use state-of-the-art acoustic technology to find the fish stock and take samples with a net. The data they collect is called the ABCs of stock assessment, which stands for abundance, biology, and catch. Fishery scientists estimate the abundance or amount of hake in the ocean and collect biological data to determine things like age and growth rates. Meanwhile, fishermen provide catch data by reporting the amount of fish caught while fishing. All that data is then fed into statistical models that range from simple to complex based on the available data for a given stock. The model results in a stock assessment that we can use to determine a sustainable level of fishing. The data will never be perfectly clear. During a hake population boom year, the fish are too small for surveys to count precisely, making it difficult to forecast how many hake will be there in the future. Other years, creatures like squid make an unexpected move into hake territory and obscure results. Issues like these can lead to uncertainty in stock assessment data, which impacts how scientists interpret the data and how managers decide on annual catch limits for the stock. In 2009, the hake survey resulted in a high estimate. In 2011, the hake survey had a low estimate. It was uncertain which estimate was most accurate, but the low 2011 survey suggested that managers should lower annual catch limits in 2012. Since vessel surveys are expensive, we have to wait 2 years before more data were available to inform the status of the hake stock again. Not wanting to wait, the fishing industry approached NOAA with an idea: combine another hake survey with the 2012 scheduled sardine survey. Though the two species live in very different environments and require different types of fishing gear, scientists and industry work together to carefully plan and execute the sardine hake combined survey. While scientists were working aboard the stealthy Bell M Shimada using sonar to find both species and trawling for sardines, a second ship, the Forum Star, provided by industry, trawled for hake. The combined sardine hake survey did help clear up the earlier uncertainty of the survey estimates. However, the number of young fish remains high, and NOAA scientists continue to develop cutting-edge sonar technology to improve estimates of these younger fish before they are harvested by the fishery. The assessment brought good news for the hake fishery. Managers decided to raise the catch target by 45% over the year before. The bottom line, fishery stock assessments are the backbone of successful science-based fisheries management. Rich data streams, strong partnerships, and advanced technology combine to produce world-class science. The U.S. approach for managing fisheries sustainably has become an international model for addressing the challenges facing global ocean fisheries today. Thanks to this process, the fishing industry, coastal communities, and our economy can benefit from profitable and sustainable U.S. fisheries.
All right, so that's a quick overview of kind of what a stock assessment's all about. Again, we take in the survey data, feed it into these statistical models. That then goes to this regulatory body. This body is called the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And it's a consortium of, there's industry involved, NOAA's involved, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, they're involved as well. And basically they get together, they review these models, they review for accuracy, they try to take everyone's input, and then they try to basically set these catch limits every year. And so that's, again, in my division, my FRAM division, or the FRAM division within Northwest History Science Center, we're the folks that actually do those stock assessments as well. So the other big thing then in my division is we actually do a bunch of just pure scientific research that feed these stock assessments. And there are really four types of surveys that we do. So we do a groundfish bottom trawl survey, which happens basically from May through October of each year. We do a Southern California hook and line survey, which really focuses on the untrawlable habitat areas, so the places where the trawl survey cannot reach. And that occurs off of Southern California, and that actually works with recreational fishermen to do that survey, whereas a trawl survey, we work with commercial fishermen. You heard about that hake acoustic survey, we do that survey as well on the big white NOAA boats. And then finally, we do a number of habitat surveys. We really actually try to understand what's the habitat and the different species habitat associations out there. So, whatever, here's a quick screenshot of just kind of the back deck of a trawl survey. So, a couple of my colleagues there, they've basically worked up the fish at this point, but you can see the massive net in the back there. Essentially, what happens is they pull off this net of fish, you could get a huge duck dumper, and they start sorting into all those gray and orange baskets right there. They start weighing those things, they sort it by species, and then by the sex, so it says if it's male or female. They'll start weighing and lengthening all that information, all the catch. They'll, in certain instances, they'll take subsamples and they'll cut out the what's called the otolith, which is a couple of bones, bone fragments that are in the brain cavity, which you can use for aging the fish. And then we also will weigh them individually as well. And then we might do other special sampling as well. We might cut out some ovaries if we want to do some maturity studies and stuff like that. So it's a pretty intense operation. You go out there, and if anyone's ever interested, we do take volunteers, so it's a great opportunity if you want to get your hands dirty, very dirty, and doing kind of and really seeing what a trawl survey is about. The trawling that we do is it's a much smaller net, so we're trying not to disrupt things as much. So it's a much smaller net and a little bit more focused. We do kind of a randomized sampling up and down the coast, and then we feed that into our statistical models. Go back here. So, and then this is kind of we have our hook and line survey, which is a much smaller operation. This occurs off the coast of Southern California. And this is kind of what we call the cutter station. So we have a scale over here for weighing it. You know, this setup is very manual still. We're trying to actually go through a whole automation process. So we do have an electronic scale here, but then there's a manual lengthening board here. Then a person will actually end up cutting the fish open and getting some samples, which we're going to see right here. So he's cutting off a fin clip. That's what you use to get DNA samples. And now he's going to actually harvest the otolith, which is that couple of those bone fragments in the brain cavity. And essentially, it's almost like counting rings on a tree, is what it is. Is that the age of the fish, you can literally count. You look at the otolith under a microscope, you literally count the number of edges in there and figure out what the age of the fish is. So those are the otoliths right there that he's putting on his hand. So it's a pretty laborious process to actually, and so he'll weight it, he'll get the otolith, he may take an ovary sample as well, he'll sex it. And that's kind of what happens on the hook and line survey. And they go cover about 150 different sites down off of Southern California. So what's kind of some of the data that looks like coming out of this? So here we're seeing a length frequency, some length frequency charts for the various years. And kind of what's interesting here is you can start seeing some different generations of fish that are occurring here. So if you look kind of closely up top, you kind of see where there's a spike and it's kind of moving to the right. So we're seeing length along here, so things are getting older in age. And then you see what we call new recruitment down here in like 2011. You see a whole new population kind of coming and growing in here as well. So we're very interested in those things, like what's the age and the different ranges of fish as well that we have out there for a given species. So bocaccio is actually one of the kind of endangered species out there that we're really trying to recover still. So we really monitor that one pretty closely.
Was that a bocaccio, the one that was just shown? Okay.
Yeah, that one was. What am I going to show here? So this next one is a little bit, we're going to talk about kind of the state of the stock and how things have actually been rebuilding over the past 20 years.
More good news for U.S. fisheries in 2014. The number of U.S. fish stocks on the overfishing and overfish list dropped to an all-time low. Also, we continued to rebuild stocks, bringing the total number of rebuilt U.S. marine fish stocks to 37 since 2000. The terms overfishing and overfish describe the status of a stock relative to its ability to produce maximum sustainable yield. That's the largest long-term average catch that can be obtained from a stock. A stock on the overfishing list means the annual catch rate is too high. A stock on the overfish list means the population size is too low. Last year, 6 stocks were removed from the overfishing list. 2 were removed from the overfish list, and 3 were rebuilt. The 3 rebuilt stocks were butterfish from the Gulf of Maine to Cape Hatteras, gag grouper in the Gulf of Mexico, and the mid-Atlantic coast stock of golden tilefish. With these fish stocks rebuilt, fishermen and fishing communities can expect some positive impacts in the future, such as increased catch limits for butterfish, a more predictable Gulf of Mexico gag grouper fishery for fishermen, and a steady supply to consumers from seafood dealers. And consideration of increased catch limits for mid-Atlantic tilefish. The science-based management process under the Magnuson-Stevens Act is working to end overfishing and rebuild stocks. We sustainably manage all 469 fish stocks in federal waters. Because of this science-based sustainable fishery management approach, the percentage of stocks on the overfish and overfishing list is at an all-time low. Only 8% are on the overfishing list, and 16% are on the overfished list. With the help of our partners in the fishing community, regional fishery management councils, states, and Congress, we'll continue to build on these efforts and identify opportunities to strengthen the biological and economic sustainability of U.S. fisheries.
All right, so that's kind of after, again, we really got, things got really busy in like 2000 when we really started, you know, enacting some rules and regulations in here to try to actually start rebuilding some stocks. You can see that things are actually improving in the U.S. at least. Can't say that so much worldwide, but the U.S. is really taking the lead on trying to actually be responsible stewards of the ocean, if you will. Okay, so I talked about a little bit the different kind of data streams that we have. So I'm a data guy, and so we're trying to basically do a big modernization of our system. So we've got certain pieces that I talked about, that observer program and the economic data collection program, which are really part of the regulatory body. And so we collect those data sets. Then we do, I mentioned kind of those four big survey types that we do as well right in here. And then we also do a bunch of other kind of video data collections and whatnot. So we're going through kind of a big modernization and trying to expose this information to the public so people can use it for whether scientific researchers want to use it or other policymakers and whatnot. And so we're basically building a data warehouse, which we're looking to release at the end of next month, where you can go and query it by a number of different interfaces and use a number of different tools. So you can go via a simple web page and actually go query it, which looks like this. So it's got a little 3D spinning globe and whatnot. You can come in here and say, I'm interested in Petrali sole. Show me what my trawl survey catch is from 2006 to 2010. And you can see kind of what our sampling looks like up and down the West Coast. And it's this sampling then that feeds those statistical models that go into the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. So I think that's really kind of what I wanted to talk about. I thought I'd throw out a few interesting issues and questions here, knowing that some of you are up here studying environmental ethics. That can come up when we talk about fishing and kind of how things are set up and, you know, should we be harvesting fish and stuff like that even to begin with. So, you know, we start right at the top, the IFQ, that's basically a cap and trade system. And there's this notion of the commons out there, right? Well, I view it as, and this is Todd Hay speaking, not Noah, but I view it as, you know, fish are basically part of the commons, right? It's like your oxygen out there. You breathe that, but we all have ownership over that as well, but no individual person actually owns it. So I view the fish as part of the commons. So, but basically what we're saying is, hey, fisherman A now kind of owns part of the commons, and they can harvest that within certain guidelines. So there are a lot of interesting kind of ethical issues concerning that, or legal issues as well that we could talk about. There's also this notion as to, you know, okay, I work in a science organization and we help to drive policy. There's this notion as that should scientists be purely objective or should they be more on the activism front? We do work a lot with a bunch of the environmental organizations, so like Nature Conservancy or Environmental Defense Fund and whatnot. And so that's another kind of interesting topic area that we could discuss as well. You get into very much into the ethics realm of, can you treat nature as a standing reserve for human consumption? Should we be doing that, right? Does that violate kind of the deep ecological principles, or is that an okay thing to do? I can certainly give you my opinion, but I want to hear what your opinions are on that. Another concern is, hey, you guys are out there, you're scientists, but you're killing all these fish, right? You do trawling, that's nasty stuff. Yeah, we do, right? We do trawl. We view it as, hey, we do need to sample things. We need to understand what's the state of affairs out there. Without being able to measure and sample, we really don't know the state of things. We don't know if they're good, they're bad, or what. We do recognize fish are a very healthy food source as well, right? And so we're trying to ensure that we have, you've heard that term, maximum sustainable yield. We want to make sure that we can harvest as much as we can, but we still have enough out there that they're going to reproduce themselves. So we're not depleting the stock. So we view that as very important. There's also this notion of government outreach versus kind of this libertarian nature, right? We're basically putting an observer on every single trawl vessel out there. Not sure everyone's too happy about that, but that's what we do. And it works. You know, we've seen a decrease in the disc, you know, the bycatch, a discard, and we were able to better monitor the overall status of the stocks. And then finally, you know, like I said, is there's kind of this underlying motivation, this deep ecological motivation versus these kind of market-driven forces. We partner very closely with industry. We kind of have to, right? They're the ones out there doing the day-to-day fishing. We charter the vessels when we go to our trawl survey sampling. We work with the recreational fishing groups when we do that hook and line sampling. So we're working very closely with industry. They're part of that Pacific Fisheries Management Council, as are the states, as are, you know, as NOAA. And so we all work together to try to come up with, well, what are these limits we want to set? And you know, there has been a lot of angst between, say, NOAA and the commercial sector, especially if you go like to the East Coast. There's a lot of, to the point of where NOAA folks couldn't really go out to the commercial docks and whatnot without being threatened in certain instances. Because people felt like their rights were being taken away to go out there and freely fish. But the stocks were already depleted, so it, you know, you have to kind of question that a little bit. So, that's kind of what my spiel is here. I think we had three questions awaiting us here.
At least.
So let's start with those.
Do you want the lights on?
Yeah, let's turn the lights on, Alba. Here we are. I think you had a question for us first. What type of fish do you like? How about that? Do you eat fish?
Yeah, like walleye.
Okay.
Bass.
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
Bluegill.
Okay.
You don't have to put those.
Let's see. Okay. Caught me at bad timing. Can I think about it?
I'll come back to you, but I will come back to you. Go ahead.
Do you sample, like, all the same type of fish throughout the whole year, or are there, like, different seasons that you sample differently?
So the survey that we do, so we have a couple of primary surveys. We have that trawl survey that goes from May to October. And so really, it's a random sampling is what we do. Yeah, so we call these fishery-independent sampling. We're not going after a specific fish type. As opposed to we've gridded up the entire West Coast in about 11,000 different 2 nautical miles by 1 nautical mile cell, and we randomly select cells to go and sample. And so we've hit so many of those cells over the past 10, 15 years, and we're just trying to kind of complete our sampling of that. So it's very much a random. We'll go out there, we'll test the station, we think we can get a decent trawl out of it. We'll drop the net down for 15 minutes, we'll pull the net back up. A commercial fisherman, and so ours is a much smaller net, we put it down for 15 minutes at a time, we pull it up. Commercial fishermen is a much larger net. They can put it down for hours at a time. They'll just drag it across the floor for a long period of time. And so we're doing a lot, you know, more spot kind of sampling to try to figure out, hey, what type of fish are in this location? And then that's when we work them up. We do, you know, we length them, we sex them, we weigh them, all that sort of stuff. So we can really get that kind of, we can create charts like that length, frequency, distribution chart I showed you up there. And then those, again, go into that, those models.
What do you do with the fish after you do all your sampling?
So some of the fish, if it's marketable, we will actually bring it to market, and we will sell that to help defray the cost of the survey. The other fish is discarded. But we have to go through the same permitting process that the fishermen do. So even for the federal boats that we charter, we have to go get permits for them, just as the other folks do. It's a weird thing, right? It's like, no, we're asking another arm of NOAA to give us a permit, but we do that. So, go ahead.
So when you guys go out, what do you consider like representative sample size? Or do you do a power analysis ahead of time, or is it just?
What's a representative sample size? So at the end of like a trawl season, we end up getting about 800 different toes is what we do. And so for each one of those toes, we'll actually qualify whether it's good or it's successful or not of a toe. So we've got a whole set of protocols that we go through in terms of what the different specimens, different species of fish for what the type of sampling we want to do. So like a typical trawl, we'll put the net down for 15 minutes. We have some measurement devices on the bottom of the net where we can see if it's actually sitting on the bottom or if it's bouncing all over the place. So we require that net be on the bottom for at least 13 of those 15 minutes and that there aren't any obvious rips and whatnot where we would have lost sample. We'll pull that net up And pretty much we'll make a determination to look at a bunch of the sensor time series data that we have and make a determination whether that was a successful code or not. From there, then we start sorting all the fish. And based on the species type, we'll do a different sampling on those species. So some species we might want to get pretty much everything we're going to weigh. We're going to weigh it, and then we might take subsamples from there that we're actually going to age, and we're going to length, and we're going to sex and do further sampling. And then even from there, there's a further group where we're going to do more work. We're going to do further work up where you might work with a professor from Oregon State or whatnot, and they say, hey, we would love to get maturity samples for Boccaccio or Pacific Ocean Perch or something like that. And so we'll get special samples that we send to their lab and whatnot. So we work very collaboratively with a bunch of the universities, Oregon State, University of Washington, Moss Landing Marine Laboratory, that's another big one. So a bunch of these different laboratories out there. So the sampling size really depends on the protocol that's established.
Gotcha.
And so we have a bunch of standard survey protocols, but then there are also protocols established by these external organizations that are asking us to help collect data for them. So it kind of varies a little bit. I don't know if that totally answers your question, but hopefully it gives you a sense. Who's my second question, number two, over here? You? Okay.
So in terms of rebuilding populations, how would you say NOAA kind of enforces those regulations? Would you say they're more of they take an attempt less fishing? Like fishing is the main problem? Like overfishing would be the problem? Or would you say I don't know, there could be millions of reasons, populations are declining. We've talked about dams being a possible problem or fishing. Just kind of all of those types of issues. Like what would you say NOAA stands
for? I mean, it's a little bit of all that, honestly. Yeah. So there's a arm within NOAA Fisheries called OLE, Office of Law Enforcement. And so there are cops, basically. They're out there, they're checking fishermen to make sure they're living up to their end of the bargain in terms of following the regulations that are set. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly that wing we're really trying to monitor and ensure that people are abiding by the law. And so that's kind of the overfishing angle of things. Yeah. So my division is very focused on that side. Another division in our group is called Conservation Biology. They're very focused on how do they really preserve conservation or the ecology of the region to promote the fishing as well. So they'll actually go up the estuaries and whatnot for salmon population in particular. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at breeding grounds to try to do ecological restoration work. So they worked, I think it was CB that worked with, if you've heard of the Elwha Dam, which is in the Puget Sound, that was a dam that was actually removed. So we've done a lot of study and analysis there about, okay, can salmon population return to the Elwha to breed, to spawn and whatnot, and produce more salmon. So it's, we really try to tackle kind of all of it.
Yeah.
Also at the Northwest Science Center, we have a big ecotoxicology group. So when we had Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf, the big oil well that shot off and whatnot, it was our scientists we kind of have a focus area of ecotoxicology. It was our scientists who kind of commandeered a bunch of vessels down there. We were getting the fish samples from there, sending them back up to our lab and all the analysis of whether they were healthy or not, whether you could actually lively them.
Okay.
So, another question.
Got one behind you.
Over here.
Hey. Okay, so I am having a little trouble distinguishing the significance of each survey.
What is the surveys do?
Yeah, what's the difference between a trawl survey and a hook and line? And
So, trawl survey, we sample fish on the bottom of the ocean. So it's ground fish, we call them, right? So we have about 90 or so species where we have a fisheries management plan, FMP. So we have to have a plan for how we're going to maintain that stock, basically. That's what it says. So the trawl survey is a big one that we do out there where we can actually go sample those stock. And that's primarily, we try to go after, soft, sandy bottoms where we try to trawl. Those are good trawling locations. You don't want to try to trawl in a coral reef, right? You're just going to rip up your net, you're going to rip up coral, you're not going to get fish. So that's what we kind of focus in on, the trawl. The hook and line survey tries to get in those spaces where trawl can't reach. It's also very isolated down in Southern California, and it works with the recreational fishing group. So there, we are looking for rockfish, and so we are looking for, say, rocky regions where we don't want to put a trawl net down there for a variety of reasons, destroying the environment, If we weren't to catch a fish, we'd rip up dents, all that sort of thing. So we try to sample those regions as well. That's what the hook and line is about. Acoustics, our acoustic survey, this one is operated on the big white 220-foot NOAA vessels. This is a midwater trawl, so it's a combination of midwater trawl for the biological sampling, but it's primarily an acoustic survey. So we shoot acoustics out from bottom, you know, sound waves basically out from the vessel. We're able to measure biomass populations of Pacific hake. So hake, Pacific hake is one of the biggest fisheries in the West Coast. It's very valuable financially.
How does that work?
I can let you talk with the acousticians back at my center. I'm not the expert on that one, but I can certainly, we can talk further about that if you want, or I could get you more details. But they do a bunch of fancy modeling, right? And they have a bunch of MATLAB scripts and some very sophisticated acoustic software. They're shooting the acoustic rays out there. They're able to kind of measure biomass estimates using that. And then they'll come up with this overall biomass estimate for what they think the population of hake is in that region. And what they do then is, to try to ground truth that though, is every so often they'll do a biological sample. So they'll throw out a midwater trawl net, they'll pull up the sample and see, okay, we just measured that with our acoustic sonar. Now we're gonna actually measure what is the fish that we just caught in there. We need to do a correlation between the two and do a ground truth. So they figure out what are my true positives, what are my true negatives, et cetera. This is what I think I've seen. So the acoustic survey is very focused on hake, that hake population, because it's such a viable population. The final one is, it kind of supports all these, it's a habitat survey where we actually go down and we'll take, you know, underwater video tracks and whatnot of the habitat. So we'll try to map out what does the habitat look like up and down the coast to find the final exit resolution. And then that habitat information really informs these other ones. And we can see, hey, where would we want to do a trawl survey? Where would we want to do a hook and line survey? Those sorts of things. Let's go back over here.
So for you guys' stock assessments, you guys are determining like the fish catch, the catch limits and the stocks. When you're doing that, how, if at all, are you guys taking into account habitat conditions and the effect that trawling or any of the fishing has had on these habitats?
On those habitats?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting question. It's a tough one to answer. How the stock assessments occur today is they're really single species stock assessments. And it really, it doesn't take into account a lot of the environmental factors, like I think what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. It really is, we're looking at boccaccio, we're looking at all the catch, we're looking at the sampling that we've done, and we try to come up with this model. Where we're trying to go, and kind of what this data warehouse, the big push of it is we're trying to get to what's called integrated ecosystem assessment, where it really takes in much richer models, where you can understand, hey, what's the zooplankton that you have out there, and then how does that feed up to the higher level species, is really where we're trying to go. Getting the data is hard to do that. We've got a couple of really leading scientists who are really working on those models right now, just trying to come up with that. And so we're trying to transform as much of our own data to feed those models to do that type of assessment work. It really has not been done. You know, there have been little pilot studies that have been done to try to demonstrate that today, but it's very pretty novel at this point.
And when were you guys hoping to get that model up in
the integrated ecosystem assessment?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's really a target deadline for it yet. At least I have not heard of one yet. It's I hear the chatter about, hey, we really want to do IEA. The actual IEA folks are actually in a different division. So I'm in the Fran, they're in our conservation biology division, but we work closely with them. And a couple of our stock assessors really are publishing papers, you know, hand in hand with those guys. It hasn't really been a target date, I've heard. I would say, I don't know if there's much going on this year, probably the year after, I think we get really serious about it. I mean, they're publishing papers and doing more and more models with it, but really to get our data in place where we can feed that effectively, I think, in a year or so. Yes?
My question is sort of similar. NOAA is a part of the Department of Commerce, right?
Correct.
So how does that view of the fish as a commodity, like an economic commodity, change the, how does it impact the amount of ethical practices that you use in your research?
So it's interesting, right? It's like, where does NOAA fit? Where should it fit? And so one can make an argument that NOAA could fit very well over in like the Department of the Interior, like alongside the U.S. Geological Service, or Survey, excuse me. It grew out of Department of Commerce, it grew out of what was called the Bureau of Fisheries, I think is what it's called, because of the large economics of it, right? So your question is, how does that impact our ethical behavior in terms of our sampling and whatnot? I don't know if I see a big impact in that sense. I mean, I don't see, we're in commerce, I don't see a lot of influence in commerce in terms of driving the decisions that we make. We certainly work with the industry closely, right? And so we are very concerned about having viable fishing communities out there. There's definitely been kind of a, there's always a bit of a tension there. There's always kind of the market-driven force, and then there's kind of the environmental, you know, ethical approach. We kind of have to straddle that line a little bit. We have to do both. We have some folks who definitely veer towards wanting to do more of the environmental work. Other folks are certainly on more of a market-driven approach. At the end of the day, the regulations we're putting in place are really more market-driven type of regulations, right? But it's with the underlying belief that those actually can help us improve the environment as well. So it's a fine balance. I don't know if I have a good answer for you on that one. But it's definitely a timely question, I think. So.
And do you get a lot of interest from special interests, environmental type groups on that subject?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're one of the most litigated agencies in federal government. Mm. Both on the commercial fishing sector, also on the environmental sector. Mm. We kind of get hit at from both sides. You know, they want their approach to win the day, and the environmentalists want their approach to win the day, and try to get this happy balance. So it's hard. It's hard to come up with what the right balance is.
NOAA takes care of the fisheries from mile 3
to mile 200.
To mile 200. States the rest.
States from 0 to 3.
So from 0 to 3.
Yeah.
The interface between federal, state, salmon interests, dam interests, how much does NOAA get drawn into those?
Oh, we're right in the thick of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely right in the thick of it. Tribes are another big one.
Oh, yes.
The tribal nations are very big.
We
try to work very close with them. So we don't really go inland except for salmon.
Right.
Salmon, we run with salmon all the way back.
That's what I thought.
And so we go all the way up the streams and whatnot. And so in our center, half of our center is just salmon. I mean, it's just what they do. But all the other stuff, that then gets handled by Geological Service and stuff like that, or the states as well. We work very closely with the states. I mean, we have to, right? I mean, we share our survey data with them. They don't really do a lot of their own surveys just because of funding limitations. But they're trying to. They're trying to get a bit more engaged when they can on that front. In Washington, on our habitat side, we're working with, there's a big kind of consortium of tribes up there where we're trying to work with them to really share habitat data. In fact, we may end up hosting a bunch of their habitat data just because we have some infrastructure to do that. But it's very much a collaborative effort. We're very much partners in it with those folks. Who's my third question? All right, we'll come back.
So I don't know if this is the right question to ask, but are there any numbers that you've come across recently in the surveys that you've taken that have been sort of shocking or maybe
like good or bad or different from what we thought they would be?
Yeah. Like something that requires we really need to do something about this. Just as a reason.
Trying to think if I can think of anything where that occurred. I know the last trawl season, I don't know if I have a good answer. I think that probably comes to mind most is I know we had this very significant halibut catch in one of our one region that we weren't expecting. I'm trying to think of where it was. I don't remember where it was. I want to say it was almost off of Washington or something like that. That was a little bit surprising. I mean, it was a large number of halibut, unexpectedly large number of halibut. So I think that kind of shocked people. I don't know if that's, we've seen the effects of that kind of occur in any of our stock assessment models yet, though. The stock assessments take a long time to run. And so there's just a lot of processing and getting the data properly cleansed and whatnot. And then what happens is we have this Pacific Fisheries Management Council. They meet every year, but they kind of set limits. Like in 2015, they'll set limits for 2015 and 2016. So they kind of do 2 years at a time. And so this halibut, some of these halibut numbers, I don't know when we would see that effect take place or be kind of integrated into some of the decision making. But that would be maybe one of the things I could think of. I'm not sure I can think of anything else off the top of my head, unfortunately. Yes?
Can you say more about the activist piece, what the kind of influence over policymakers entails, and whether you get pushback? I mean, do your recommendations normally get followed?
So, yeah, I mean, we're not the decision makers by any means. We try to feed sound science, best available science is what we say, into the decision makers. We're on, you know, a number of the committees and whatnot, and ensure the science is sound. I think, I don't know if you're talking more about the quote, the item I have listed up there in terms of the scientists as activists. I mean, yeah. In some sense, we don't really act as activists ourselves because we're just trying to feed sound kind of objective science into it. To me, it's a bigger question as to should a scientist try to be a policy activist? Because, you know, if they really have knowledge that could help improve something, are they just publishing papers or are they really going to try to go beat the drum and say, hey, policymakers, you need to do something about this, and this is what you should be doing.
And what do you think about that? That's right.
I actually think they should be involved. I think they should be leading that. I mean, what's the point of doing the science if you're not going to be trying to influence something? It's interesting. Papers are fun to read and all that, but if you're not changing things, I view that as a bit problematic, I guess. So, what other questions do we have? Yes.
Can you say a little bit about stock assessments for salmon? I mean, I guess I'm thinking in particular the challenges of something that is both salt and freshwater and where you have hatchery and kind of wild fish. It's a little more difficult than others.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I actually can't say it, just from the sense of my division doesn't do it.
Okay.
So salmon are handled in a different division. I honestly don't know what they do there, to be honest. We do, our bio division is really about the ground fish, so we're the bottom folks, and then the hake as well. I'm not sure that, like I said, about half the center does salmon, and so there's a very strong emphasis. I just don't know, I honestly don't have a good sense as to how it's managed. I mean, that's one of the Endangered Species Act species. And so I tell you what we do on our surveys, you know, when we get that, we try to save them right off the bat. We will, we'll say, is it adult, sub-adult? Is it hatchery born or not? And by that, we look at a fin clip, and hatchery born, they get a fin clip clipped off. And then we say kind of what we try to assess the maturity of it as well. Boom, once we're done with that, we throw it back over to try to save it because they're on the ESA list. And I don't know, gosh, do I know how stock assessments are doing this for salmon? I don't. Salmon, you know, there's some species like that, they're just handled separately. They're so important, they're handled separately. Salmon, halibut, sturgeon, eulachon, some of these other ones like that, they're just handled separately because they're viewed as such valuable species. And they're usually at a BSA, but they're just kind of treated individually. Like there's an International Pacific Halibut Commission. There's a whole separate joint Canadian-US commission that just looks at halibut. And there's like 30 or 40 people, and they do their own surveys up and down the West Coast, just looking for halibut. It's fascinating. It's like I met this woman from there the other day. I'm like, who are you guys again? Exactly. Just halibut? What sense does that make? You know, but yeah, sure enough, that's what they do. So,
yeah. What about the bycatch? I mean,
bycatch.
So
yeah.
For instance, you also in the bycatch are not just fish.
Correct.
There are turtles, correct?
If we come across a turtle, if we come across any marine mammals, those are handled specially.
Or turtles are not mammals.
True, but if we do come across any, it's kind of lumped in with the marine mammals as well, though. If we come across any of those special types of species, we try to save those, or we try to avoid them to begin with. If we see any type of mammals out there, we have to do basically a sighting first off. If we see any type of mammal activity at all, we will not trawl that region.
So, in other words, if your observer is on a boat, a trawler, and he or she sees mammals, he or she has the power to tell them you can't trawl them.
Yeah, let me step back from there. I'm talking on our own survey, not for commercial vessels. I don't know what happens actually with our observers and if they see like turtles and whatnot. Honestly, I'm not sure what happens there.
I think there's a lot of bycatch that just dies.
Oh, yeah, most of the bycatch dies.
But I mean, it's non-fish, turtles and mammals.
I honestly don't know. We do collect that information. Our observer does collect that information.
And my reading about the oceans is they're in trouble. That we have seen them as a limitless resource.
Right.
It seems to me that what Noah is about is the science is nothing is limitless.
Not at all. No. So again, federal waters are 300 to 200.
Right.
That's where we're. That's really what we can do. Right.
Right.
So we feel like for that region, we've been able to at least get our heads around it and make some progress in terms of bringing the stock back. go beyond 200, yeah, it's in trouble. The other countries, they're in trouble, very much so. And so it's like, how do you take kind of the policy and the approaches that we've done, and how do you bring that to a larger worldwide audience? It's very hard to do.
And then just one quick question, I know I asked more than one, but mm-hmm. So the littoral zones are where the most fish are, is that correct, usually?
Depends on the type of fish, but that's why the states handle that, a lot of those, you know, Dungeness crab and stuff like that. Yeah.
I got one.
Yes.
One thing I don't quite understand is how, if like the commercial fishers are able to go for multiple hours with yeah. their trawl, like how does it doesn't seem like they could know what they're grabbing and pulling up. So how does
they will when they pull it up?
Right. What?
They will when they pull it up.
Right. So how does having like various information about you know what needs to be protected and put on whatever list things. How does like having that effectively like
does
stop
it change
them from grabbing them? You know what I
mean? Well, so you get a commercial fisherman who goes out there, he trawls, he brings up a big bag, and he'll do that, you know, many times. He'll ice it off, he'll bring it back in. So we'll see what they caught, we'll see what they threw over. So you get kind of a complete accounting as to what they harvested. So that happens throughout the year, right? So we're getting daily information that's being updated into our systems, and we can track that. The Pacific Fisheries Management Council meets multiple times a year, 4 or 5 times a year. And so they'll change limits kind of throughout the year and make addendums based on what they're seeing as well. So it's not real time. But it's an attempt to try to get in-season adjustments as well. So like just this year for salmon, we had a salmon question. We started providing a service where now we can give like daily reporting on salmon activity. Mm-hmm. We get information in on a daily basis. We can report that back out with the discard and the retained catch, combine that together. Then they can do just more real-time kind of in-season salmon management. So if they see a lot of salmon being caught, more than they ever thought, they may need to cut down their catch levels the very next day. The catch limits, but that's it's hard, right? I mean, you data only comes in at a certain rate. It's a lot of data, and just trying to get an effective management system in place. It kind of varies per species, and what we view as the importance of a species as well.
Yeah, I feel like even if you have an important species, if they're randomly grabbing it, I don't see how like that they could not.
Well, they're pulling it up, but once they come to port, I mean, we know what they pulled up, right? So we see what allocation, what they pulled up versus what we've kind of set as our overall limits. So is there a possibility that we could set a limit, the entire fleet could go out in the day, pull everything up, and massively go over that limit? Possible. Highly unlikely.
I was just wondering, like, on your average work day, like what do? You go out to the ocean, or like do you?
If only, no, I don't. I mean, I'm a data guy, right? So I'm in the office. I have been out on our trawl survey, our hook and line survey, but our survey team members, I mean, they are out. There are 2 40-day surveys is what they do. So they'll be out there for weeks at a time doing trawl surveys. Our hook and line survey is just like about a 2 week. 20-day survey, so you go out for a couple weeks at a time, type of deal. So, and then you know other folks, but people are kind of doing surveys out there. Our habitat folks do a bunch of additional surveys as well. So they'll do a bunch of like underwater video collection. Our observers are out there all the day, all the time with the commercial fleet. So it kind of depends on what role you're in, because of what you're doing. But maybe you'd be a good volunteer. When you come out, yes.
This is not your area of expertise, but another ethical question for the consumers, those of us who eat fish. Given that it sounds like the United States regulates and tries to preserve more than other countries, do you think consumers have an ethical duty to know where our fish comes from and purchase some fish and not other fish?
Yeah, absolutely so. Absolutely so. I could show you a little video. We got some funding, actually, from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Gordon Moore being the kind of the guy at Intel who did Moore's Law, right? But they still have a big foundation. They had this marine conservation initiative. And so they provided some funding. And part of the idea was just that, where his thinking was, you could go into the grocery store, you could see like a little, what they came up with these terms, you could see this NOAA Gold symbol on there, a little QR code, you could scan it, you see, oh, you know, Bob caught this on February 2nd off the coast of Newport, Oregon, and then you could rate it, oh, that was really fresh fish or whatnot, right? Where you could have kind of market forces driving quality as well. But it's a whole, you know, it's not farm to table, it's you know, boat to table now type of thing. That whole vision as to how can we get there. That vision is definitely out there. So I would say like that the Moore Foundation, what they're trying to do now is they're trying to go beyond just the U.S. marketplace because they feel like, okay, we've got some good momentum in the U.S. places. We've started getting policies in place. They're trying to really understand now international markets and how you can use international markets to try to drive that quality as well and kind of the sustainable fishing practices as well. That's going to be a hard one to do. It's just, because you get out past 200, it's no man's land. It's, you know, it's international waters. It's who's going to come regulate that? The UN? They don't have a country, you know, I mean, there's no one out there. So you can get these people just come out there and just do some serious damage, and they can go and do it. So I think it's very much part of the onus is on us. Part of it, it's just to demand good quality and you know, known sources of your food, absolutely. I have one final question.
I'm not sure if you already answered this, but I'm going to ask anyway. So in the beginning, you raised the overfishing problem, mm-hmm. and then you mentioned the declaration and the ground fish buyback. But how else has this research program contributed to the improving the health of fish ecosystem or solving the overfishing problem?
Well, so, I mean, we're firmly of the belief that it's definitely helped. I mean, we've seen a number of stocks being rebuilt. We've seen some stocks come off some of those endangered lists, and you know, other ones look like they're going to be rebuilt as well. So there's a group called the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They put out a seafood watch. There's a website. They put out a list of, hey, these are the fish you should eat. These are the ones you should not eat. So kind of back to your question as well. These are the ones you should avoid because they're overfished or whatnot. And so just this past year, they came up and they were able to bring back a bunch of the rockfish. So rockfish were really depleted. Well, a number of years. They used to be called red snapper. Mm-hmm. Remember that term? Mm-hmm. They're really depleted. Well, just this past year, they were able to reintroduce a bunch of rockfish back to, hey, these are good things that you can go and eat. These are now being sustainably managed. And so, I mean, we actually think that some things are really coming back quite well. There's still some stocks that are still very mature, but that's where we just try to set more sound policy in place. So. Okay, I think that's out of our time. Sorry. Thank you very much. Thank you.